I'm Rabia Yeaman for The Digital Divide. On today's program, we'll hear a recent interview with Cory Doctorow. Cory was in Portland this week to promote his recent science fiction novel Homeland, a sequel to his previous award-winning novel Little Brother, a New York Times bestseller. Cory Doctorow is co-editor of Boing Boing and a sometimes columnist for The Guardian, Locus, and Publishers Weekly. He was named one of the web's 25 influencers by Forbes magazine and a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. Welcome to The Digital Divide, Cory.
Thank you very, very much.
You're here in Portland because you have a new science fiction book that you're promoting.
That's right.
It's called Homeland, and it's a sequel to another book that you wrote called Little Brother.
That's right, yeah.
Would you give our listeners a synopsis of the new book, Homeland?
Sure. Well, it kind of picks up where Little Brother left off. So Little Brother was a novel about kids who, after a terrorist attack and then subsequent police crackdown in San Francisco, declare war on the DHS, kick them out of San Francisco, and restore the Bill of Rights to America with cryptographically secured networks made out of hacked Xboxes. And the new one, Homeland, is set a couple of years later, and it's about a much less visible kind of crisis. It's not the kind of crisis where someone blows up a bridge and all of a sudden there's police on every street. It's the kind of crisis where all of a sudden it seems like all of your neighbors have got foreclosure notices up and your parents don't have work anymore and people are dropping out of university because they can't afford the tuition and every protest seems to end in some kind of violence. And in this scene, in this against this backdrop, a young man who is the hero of the first book, Marcus, comes into possession of a thumb drive full of leaks and has to figure out what to do with it.
You know, it doesn't really sound like fiction.
Well, it's a way of dramatizing both current events and futuristic events in a way that I hope takes some of the policy questions and turns them into a narrative with some emotional depth as well.
That's pretty exciting. Well, you write science fiction, among other things. Do you think that science fiction has the power to solve some of the biggest problems we face as humans?
So I think science fiction is remarkably poor at predicting things. I think if you actually look at the science fiction track record on prediction, you'd find that like throwing darts would get you better results. I mean, we tend to score science fiction's predictive power the way you would if you fired a shotgun at a barn and then drew a target around the place where all the pellets hit. You know, there people have made lots of science fiction predictions and we only remember the ones that came true. But what science fiction's really good at is pointing out what's going on in the present by making up these futuristic parables. And the way I think about it is imagine you went to the doctor and you had a tickly throat, a sore throat, and she went and she took a swab and she put it in a petri dish and left it over the weekend so that by the end of the weekend she could look at the petri dish and see what was growing there and tell you what was going on in your own body. Science fiction can take pluck just one technology or one idea out of the world around us and build a kind of toy world in a bottle. You know, a world where that's the totalizing force that takes over everything. Not a world that's predictive. We're never going to live in a world where, you know, drones are the one salient fact of the world. But by writing a story about drones where drones are the one salient fact of the world, it tells us something about what drones are doing in the present. It helps us see in the present something that's too small and nascent for us to make sense of.
Well, that's a really rational and unusual perspective.
Oh, well, thank you.
Do you think that the internet will ever get credit for having been as profound as it is, you know, as profound as language?
Boy, I don't know if the internet's as profound as language. It's pretty important. But
well, it has eliminated all logistics from communications that previously didn't exist.
Well, it certainly radically reduced the logistics of communications. I mean, when I was an activist in the 80s, 98% of my job was stuffing envelopes and writing names on the front of them, and 2% was figuring out what to put in the envelopes. And so now we get the envelopes and the stamps and the addresses for free. And that's profound, right? Because by definition, rich and powerful forces and institutions were already organized. They could afford the organizational hurdle that you have to overcome in order to get people together to do stuff. Whereas, you know, by definition, people who are powerless aren't organized. And so, by dropping the cost of organization, you really do change the landscape. I still don't know that it's as important as language. Language is pretty important, but it's very important. We don't have to choose. I think we can say that language is important and the internet is important and rankings are unimportant to that question.
Okay. You've talked a lot about maker and hacker spaces, and even in your books you describe different characters as being makers. And
I wrote a book called Makers.
You did write a book called Makers. So tell our listeners who might not know that word now has multiple meanings. What does it mean in the context that you're using it?
Sure. I mean, so there have always been tinkerers, you know, and I have a friend who's an inveterate yard sailor in Burbank, and he goes around to all these houses in Burbank that were built post-war, and the thing he loves about them, because he's a grease monkey, builds hot rods, and the thing he loves about it is every one of those houses has a workshop in the garage. Because there was a time when everybody had a workshop in a garage.
So a pegboard. Everybody had a pegboard.
So he's got like tools for, you know, the rest of his life and several livelihoods beyond. But there's a thing that's different today. So we went through this period where there were no user serviceable parts inside anything. And where what's more, the cost of replacing things was often lower than the cost of repairing them. And we are now entering an era where some of the ethos that came up around software, where anything you wanted to do in software, first of all, someone had already done 90% of anyways and posted the source code somewhere on the internet so you could download it and add your 10%, where some of that ethos is coming to the physical world, where things that you might want to make with your hands or things that you might want to adapt with your hands, a tool that you buy in a shop but isn't quite the tool you want. It's a tool that's made for an average person, and none of us are average. We all have our own idiosyncrasies. That is now easier than it's ever been, because on the one hand, material culture is cheaper than it's ever been. There's devices and materials available in great plenty, thanks in part to, you know, consumer society and the huge mountains of waste that it generates. But also there's this easily networked expertise where there is someone out there who's done most of what you're trying to do, and it's one search away to find their documentation of their problem. And then when you try to take it the next 10% and inevitably run up against something you didn't anticipate and discuss it with other people on the internet, that discussion itself becomes a palimpsest or a set of instructions that the next person can follow as they kind of push it along. So we have this kind of incremental improvement and this huge record, a kind of disorganized record of how to configure anything in the world to suit your tastes. And one of the expressions of that is that people are physically locating places where they have shared access to tools and technologies. And we call these maker spaces or hacker spaces, or in London, the one that's above my office is called the Hack Space, but it's all much the same thing. And these are places where you have metal shops and wood shops, but also access to things like 3D printers and laser cutters, where you might have workshops on how to use this equipment. And oftentimes they shade over into crafting. So you see a lot of textile work, crocheting, knitting.
We have I can think of two of these types of spaces that I'm aware of, and probably are more.
Oh, yeah. Here I mean, there's Portland. Tons of them. Yeah. Yeah, no, there's tons of them. And it's a remarkably satisfying thing to do, to get together with your friends and, you know, raise subscriptions and use the money to rent a space and then fill that space with cool tools. And then all of you get together and just jam and make awesome stuff. And, you know, I've been to hackerspaces all over the world, and they're inevitably just mind-boggling, right? People are just doing amazing, improbable things. There's a hackerspace in San Francisco called Noisebridge that has a space program. They've put several balloons into space with cameras and telemetry packages on them and recorded, you know, the curvature of the Earth and also you know, observations in the upper atmosphere and so on. It's pretty awesome.
This story is making me optimistic for the entire survival of mankind.
Well, I think that, you know, to the extent that our future is about using technology to solve the problems technology created, then, you know, being able to recruit the expertise of people all around and the insights of people all around, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, I'm skeptical of the idea of moving away from society, of going back to the land, of being independent, because it feels like ultimately, to be independent, you need to harness the resources of a whole society to support yourself. You know, someone at the talk I gave in Seattle last night, I was talking about security and technology and the fact that devices are sometimes compromised and spy on us. And sometimes, you know, the German government's been caught putting viruses on computers that they use to spy on people through their cameras. And schools do this sometimes with the laptops they issue. And this person said, well, what do I do to make myself secure? And I said, you know, I don't think you make yourself secure. I think we make ourselves secure. I think we work with organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, the Free Software Foundation, Software Freedom Law Center, and so on, to build out a society where that kind of thing doesn't happen very often, where the defaults of the devices you receive are better. And it's to me, it's kind of like the question, you know, how do I know that my water supply, how do I make a water supply that's safe and secure? Well, you could either you individually create your own water treatment plant and facility and sewer system and waterworks, or you could live in a civil society where we collectively do this and where we have good and transparent government that regulates it and makes sure that it's operating well.
Well, that would be like three extra conversations that I want to have about, you know, collectivity versus this kind of autonomy or single consumer unit that we have been crafted into by media and marketing for the most part to, you know, to kind of continue to grow this kind of like feudal capitalistic notion that you know can consume forever and add to infinity, which is it's just not sustainable. So there is a whole new orientation of a collective behavior and activity that the internet's a part of. It helps to facilitate that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's a paradox of productivity where the advent of the Industrial Revolution and of Fordism and Taylorism and of mass production, on the one hand, did radically lower the cost of goods. And that's important. It's substantial. The fact that everybody can afford shoes is a feature and not a bug, right? But on the other hand, it did so at the expense of a lot of personal autonomy, right? If you were a craft person who made doors, there might be a day when the weather was nice outside, and so you went and you worked on part of the process that you could do out of doors, and then when it's raining, you go inside and do part of it that you know you could do while you were indoors, and you could fit the rhythm of your work to the world around you. But when you're in an assembly line and where there's extreme path dependency, where what you do or don't do affects the person who's next in the line and then the person who's downstream from them, you have to sacrifice a lot of that autonomy. Now, the upside of that sacrifice of autonomy was the huge productivity gains, was shoes for everybody. And what I think we have now in the 21st century and with the maker movement and with automation and with the ability to communicate and collaborate across time and space using networks is the ability to harvest some of those productivity levels but without the sacrifice of personal autonomy. And I don't think personal autonomy is a bad thing. I just think that personal autonomy works best when it's part of a larger fabric where all of us exercising our personal autonomy doesn't end up making everybody miserable and poor and broke and heavily armed and with a suspicious eye on their neighbors, you know?
Well, I don't even consider that to be autonomous. I consider it to be more more puppet-like.
Yeah.
What internet laws are you most worried about right now?
Well, there's a bunch of them. I mean, you know, the one that's a lot of people are paying attention to now because of what happened with Aaron Swartz is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, 1986 statute that was about punishing people who broke into computers and made mischief there. And there are some things that people do when they break into computers that I'm staunchly opposed to. You know, the idea of someone breaking into my computer and putting a keylogger on it and capturing my passwords, I would prefer that was illegal.
Right. And identity theft is bad.
Yeah. Well, and you know,
every time.
Yeah, yeah. Stealing people's passwords, stealing people's credit card numbers, you know, vandalizing people's data and so on. The CFAA struggled with how to define hacking, with the kind of hacking that they wanted to punish. And they said, well, if you exceed your authorization on a computer that doesn't belong to you, you commit a felony. And in 1986, I think that sounded reasonable or sensible or something. Maybe over the top, maybe you'd have to rely on prosecutorial discretion to distinguish, you know, youthful hijinks from harmful behavior. in the year 2012, every computer that you, first of all, you use computers that you don't own all the time, right? Every day, all the time, every network service is attached to a computer you don't own. And all of those computers that you connect to, your authorization to use them is regulated by enormous, completely impossible to parse out user agreements and user license agreements that run to tens of thousands of words and are absolutely unreasonable and say things, you know, by using this service, you agree that we're allowed to come over to your house and, you know, punch your grandmother and wear your underwear and make some long distance calls and eat everything in the fridge, right? So some prosecutors and some judges have interpreted the CFAA in that context to mean that if you violate the terms of service, you're a felon and you can go to jail. And that clearly is bonkers, right? Maybe it's a contractual matter. Maybe they can sue you and they have to show some real damages. And if they win, you might have to show that you might have to pay some damages. But the idea that if you just put a long string of legalese on the door, that anyone who doesn't adhere to all the long string of legalese goes to jail, that's private law, right? It's essentially allowing people to write their own statutes, and then anyone who violates the statute is a felon and the state pays to put them in jail. That's not what I think the CFAA should do. Zoe Lofgren, in the wake of Aaron Swartz's suicide, introduced something called Aaron's Law that has been modified by a few people since who are legal scholars and understand this stuff. And basically it says, you know, notwithstanding everything else in the CFAA, this is not about turning user license agreements into the law. And that's not a bad start. The CFAA could probably use some more substantive reform, but that's probably a good one. The other statute that I worry about a lot is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And that's the 1998 act that was supposed to modernize American copyright. And it's part of a global regime that comes out of the WIPO copyright treaties of 1996. So lots of countries around the world have their own versions of the DMCA. The Canada has Bill C-11. In the United Kingdom, where I live, we have our adaptation of the European Union Copyright Directive. So it's a feature of law all around the world. And one of the things that's in the DMCA and in many of the national laws that are adapted from the WCT is something called anti-circumvention. And the anti-circumvention says that if you remove or tell someone how to remove an effective means of access control from a device, you're breaking the law. And that's kind of esoteric and abstract sounding, but what it fundamentally means is if you own a device, a laptop, a DVD player, a phone, a computer, you know, computers are everywhere, right? Your car is a computer, you put your body
everything
into.
Everything is a computer.
Yeah, they're all computers. And if somewhere in that computer is a system or a program that is meant to stop you from looking at some of the data the computer works with, then it's against the law to remove that program or tamper with that program or tell anyone how to do it. So it essentially says that, like, your computer is yours, but you're not allowed to look too hard inside of it. Right. And this has turned out to be a complete disaster, and not least because it's essentially a kind of blank check to people who want to design business models around hijacking people's computers, right?
Right.
And so, you know, you have things like, I want to sell you this book, but I'll only let you read it while you're in the United States. And so I'm going to write a program, a kind of HAL 9000 program, whose job is, if you try to read the book and I can tell you're not in the United States, that program is supposed to sort of swim up out of the depths of your computer
you
and
violated
say...
violated our agreement.
That's right. Yeah. I can't let you do that, Dave. You know, so that is bad for computers. It's bad for computers because when you design computers with the facility to hide from their owners what they're doing, right? To actually trick their owners about what's going on inside of them, it makes it very hard for the owners to verify what their computers are doing.
Right.
And where you have bad guys, whether those bad guys are repressive.
And you're not even really an owner at that point. You have it.
You've kind of purchased it.
But right, you're not actually an owner because if you were a real owner, you would have 100% control over it.
Yeah, your computer would be your honest servant. Right. So, you know, there's lots of bad guys out there. There's identity thieves, and there's organized crime, and there's repressive governments, and there's all kinds of institutions that would love to be inside your computer because, you know, if you think about your mobile phone, it's a camera, a microphone, location sensor. Yeah, it knows everybody you know. It knows where you've been. It knows all the things you've said to them. And so hijacking that phone and being able to spy on what that phone does, this is an immensely powerful thing.
Right.
And, you know, just last week, this sextortionist was busted And he took his cues from another guy who had tricked young women into downloading a virus that then let him operate their cameras. And then he could get pictures of them in the nude. And then having gotten pictures of them in the nude, he could blackmail them into putting on private Skype sex shows. And then because he was inside their computers, he could listen in when they said, I got to call the police. And then he could send them emails saying, I heard you saying you were going to go to the police. Don't go to the police. And it's really creepy, right? Not being able to know what state your computer is in.
That is really, really creepy.
This matters, right? Not knowing what your computer is doing matters. And so when we create laws that say it's against the law to look inside your computer, it's against the law to tell people what you found inside your computer, then we substantially undermine the security model for the information age. And I think that anti-circumvention stuff is something we really need to fix. And then there's a third thing we need to fix, which is the stored communications stuff. So when the first rules around when and how the police need to get a warrant in order to look at files that are on servers came around, the presumption was, this was in the 1980s, and the presumption was that any file that had been sitting on a server for more than 6 months had been abandoned, right? And so no warrant was necessary. You didn't need a probable cause warrant. You could just go and get them. And again, you know,
in retrospect, we know that's not true now.
Well, so this is when hard drives were really expensive, and you would flush any file that you weren't,
and all you would ever need was 20 megabytes for the rest of your life.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, 1980s, 20 megabytes was a huge amount. So now we have Gmail, right, and Facebook and so on. And Gmail is full of files that have been sitting on a server for more than 6 months, which is all the email that you have that's more than 6 months old.
Right.
And through a couple of Congresses, you know, there have been attempts to reform the Stored Communications Act, and it has, they've all failed, you know, partly because law enforcement really likes the fact that this law has not kept up with technology. And it creates this huge loophole that allows them to gain access to a lot of communications without having to show probable cause to a judge. And I'm somewhat sympathetic to...
Can we gain access to their emails other than six months legally? Is that,
you know,
does it work both ways?
I understand that there's lots of people in law enforcement who do good work and want to catch people who are doing bad things. But the problem of law enforcement is that what goes with the territory seems to be a belief in your own infallibility, a belief that you know who the bad guys are. And wherever we create a cuttable corner, that corner is always cut. As soon as we brought in the Patriot Act and we said, well, if you're chasing terrorists, you don't need a warrant, suddenly every drug dealer or suspected drug dealer was implicated somehow in terrorism, mm-hmm. because it just made their job easier, right? Yeah. If your job is to catch bad guys, you want to minimize your paperwork. And if we give people who do that a path to minimizing paperwork and maximizing their bad guy chasing, that's what they're there for, that's what they like doing, and that's what they'll do. And so we need to create, you know, checks and balances, and the Stored Communications stuff, we don't have it. So those are the three statutes that exist that I would like to fix. And then, you know, there's the whole realm of stuff that isn't regulated that should be, like ubiquitous surveillance of the internet by the NSA and so on.
Let's talk a little bit about copyright then. You can tell me if you didn't write this, mm-hmm. but I think you wrote this, and you said, in the meantime, I draw your attention to Article 2 of all Creative Commons licenses. Strip away the legalese, and what it says is copyright gives you the public rights. Fair use is real. Fair dealing is real. Minimum exemptions to copyright are real. You have the right to make all sorts of uses of all copyrighted works without permission, without Creative Commons licenses. And I want you to elaborate, because I want to use all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did write that. And you know, the point of that is that we live in a world today where in many instances where you would have the right to, say, make a brief quotation or include incidental copies of works in larger works, you know, like a photograph that has a painting in the background or what have you, where these are exceptions that would fall under fair use in the United States, which is a complicated doctrine, but which there is some case law on that provides some certainty, or where copyright law wouldn't even deal with it because it's too small, it's de minimis. Nevertheless, people routinely go and seek licenses for those uses. You know, for example, novelists routinely get licenses when they briefly quote a song lyric, one line of a song at the beginning of a chapter. And there's not really any case law that says that that's not fair use, that you shouldn't have to go and get fair use. And lots of legal scholars think it is fair use. one of the factors that courts consider when they look at fair use is whether or not there is a market that you are sidestepping in making your use. And so this is a kind of, it's a kind of one-way ratchet. If you start paying for things that you can actually get for free, you create a market for them. Mm-hmm. And then once there is a market for those things, suddenly it's not fair use anymore. So you actually kind of, there's this kind of negative externality, the spillover, right? People who go and get permission for things that they should be allowed to do without permission, those people create a world in which everybody else has to go get permission too, because they create these markets. Unfortunately, fair use has a lot of gray area in it, and so does the de minimis exemptions. One area where we see this a lot is in sampling. So in the early days of musical sampling, the assumption, if anybody even thought about whether or not it was legal to sample, the assumption was that it's just too small. It's, you know, if Dizzy Gillespie or John Coltrane can play, you know, two bars of some pop hit in the middle of a solo, then I can take two bars of that pop hit and bend it and tweak it and do stuff with it in my mix. What happened subsequently was a series of lawsuits about fair use and a bunch of bad judgments where judges said even two notes is not fair use. And so it created this world where everybody gets clearance for all of their samples, and that radically changed the character of the music that people legally make. There's lots of illegal music that's uncleared, but legally nobody makes music like the early and most profitable hip hop albums like Paul's Boutique and It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Both of those albums made, I think, north of $10 million. Both of those albums would lose something like $8 to $10 million today if all of those samples were cleared. And so nobody makes music like that anymore if they want to stay within the law. And if they don't want to stay within the law, they make that music, but they risk a lot. They risk enormous damages by doing it. What's interesting, though, is nobody has ever defended the practice of sampling, not on the grounds of fair use, but on the grounds of de minimis, that it's too small a copying for copyright to concern itself with. Judges have only been asked to consider fair use. And so we have no case law at all on this. And again, lots of legal scholars think this is de minimis, especially when you're talking about two notes. This is de minimis. This shouldn't be in the realm of what you have to seek permission for. Whether you recreate a couple of notes using a digital sampler or a horn, it's just part of how we make music. You know, there's a reason they call Brahms's first Beethoven's 10th. You know, musicians borrow from each other. And so we're still figuring this stuff out, and it would be great to see more clarity in fair use and de minimis. Unfortunately, it's very expensive. And unfortunately, where you have the really good facts that would make good cases, the people who are accustomed to getting a paycheck from getting permission for stuff that you probably don't need permission for, they walk away. So where you have someone who's got, you know, who's got clean hands, whose fact pattern looks good, who's got lawyers ready to represent them, the other side drops the legal threats and you never get a judgment. That you only get judgments from people who are somewhat compromised or don't have the resources to defend themselves.
Well, that's a great point. So one of my questions is, you know, has copyright ambiguity, you know, like bred like a new type of litigious opportunist, Getty, who troll the internet demanding payment, you know, for images that may or may not even be theirs to begin with, you know, or people, or worse, people trying to sell catalogs of collected images from other people's tumblers. And I know someone who actually had a business plan for that. And I was like, really?
Yeah, that's a bit broken. Certainly there's a lot of copyright trolling. It's not so much the stuff you were just describing. And certainly there's a bit of that from Getty and so on. But the real copyright trolls are companies like Right Haven, which thankfully is gone now. But Right Haven was the brainchild of a newspaper publisher in Las Vegas. And what he said is, I will create a company and newspapers will license the right to sue to this company. Not any of the other copyrights, just the part of the copyright that lets them sue people. And then anybody who quotes any of these newspaper articles and blog posts or whatever, even if they're tiny little quotes, will go after them and will send them bills. And if they don't pay the bill, we'll sue them, or we'll threaten to sue them. So they started engaging in what's called speculative invoicing, where they would just gather up the names of thousands of people who had made brief quotes or who maybe hadn't even made brief quotes and just send them a letter that basically said,
a demand for payment, right?
It's this, you can either go to a lawyer and pay thousands of dollars to even figure out whether we have a case, or you can just give us $500 and we'll go away.
Right.
And Righthaven, thankfully, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other public interest groups handed them their ass on a plate. But it spawned another generation of copyright trolls who mostly work on behalf of video porn companies. And what they do is they gather up the IP addresses of people who are supposedly sharing copyrighted pornographic movies on the internet, and generally often gay porn, and they send them letters and they say, we will file a lawsuit against you saying that you were downloading gay porn unless you give us some money right now.
That's extortion.
It is extortion, and hundreds of thousands of people have received these letters in America. Thankfully, judges are starting to wise up to this, and they're starting to say, because you have to go to a judge first, and you have to go to a judge and convince the judge that something's going on here, and then the judge gives you an order that you can take to the ISP, so the ISP translates the IP address into a customer's address. And the judges are increasingly saying, A, we don't think you ever plan on suing these people, right? Anyone who sticks up for themselves, you just walk away from. So you're not, what you're doing is you're using this court as part of a shakedown racket. This mm-hmm. is not about...
Totally shakedown.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with you trying to protect your interests.
Right.
And B, you're trying to say that all these people who were downloading this file were in a conspiracy together, but none of them have ever met. None of them took any affirmative step to conspire with one another. And the idea that you can walk in and with one filing get 1,000 names back from an IP address, that's, that I understand why that would save you a lot of money, but I don't understand why this court should treat thousands of people as though who never met, as though they were co-defendants. And so it's getting harder for this to happen. There's still a lot of it. In the UK, we had a company called ACS Law that was doing similar shakedown. And their email got hacked and dumped onto the internet, and the sordid details of the stuff they were doing was really, it beggared the imagination, and they were basically crooks.
Right, there you go. Well, I wanted to ask you a couple other questions. There's so many questions. I want to ask you about being a dad.
Sure.
She just turned 5.
That's right, my daughter. She turned 5 the day before I left on tour, Sunday the 3rd.
She has an impressive name.
She does.
Go for the whole thing.
Her name is Poesy Emmeline Fibonacci Nautilus Taylor Doctorow. We were only going to have one, so we figured we'd have all of our naming in one go there.
Right.
She's just Posy, though. I mean, middle names are fun. They're like Easter eggs, you know. They're like hidden treats.
It's true.
You don't have to tell anyone what your middle name is. You don't have to use your middle name,
but you get to
choose if you want.
That's true.
And so
yeah.
She's got all these names she can choose from.
Well, it's beautiful. Has being a dad made you, you know, feel more urgency about, you know, like the technological future of the planet?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm certainly aware and conscious of the fact that we are creating, we're at a cusp where we either create devices that continue to liberate people, or we create devices that are forces for control and surveillance that, you know, beggar the imagination, make Orwell look like an optimist. And so I do worry about that. I mean, I think of all the changes that have arisen in my psyche as a result of having a kid, the biggest one is that I can't enjoy fiction or films or whatnot in which there are children in danger. And that stuff used to just roll off my back. It was just, you know, I love, you know, whatever, the Poltergeist and so on, you know, like movies like that. I always really enjoy them. I like horror. I like suspense. And now that stuff, it's just not pleasurable in any way.
It's not entertaining, is it?
I don't get like a kind of a delightful frisson of terror that's then relieved. I walk away from it feeling just awful.
Well, Has being a parent made you more of an activist?
Well, yes and no. So on the one hand, it's made me, it strengthened some of my resolve. On the other hand, it's taken a bunch of the time that I would have otherwise spent being an activist and, diverted it to being a dad.
Well, making little activists is also being an activist.
That's kind of an activist role, too. I used to travel a lot more. And now that I have a daughter, I spend a lot more time close to home.
Right. You did work with Aaron Schwartz.
Yeah.
And you're still advocating on his behalf, on behalf of his work.
Mm-hmm.
Would you share with us what you'd like to say about Aaron?
Well, sure. So Aaron helped me write the book Homeland that I'm touring with. I knew that this book would have as one of its focuses a next generation political campaign that would use the internet to run a political campaign that would get someone elected without any kind of debt to large donors, so that person could be truly independent. And I wrote to Aaron and asked him, you know, if he had any ideas on these lines. And I thought I'd get a couple of bullet points back. And like an hour later, I got essentially a full-blown architectural document for designing a kind of vote-generating machine that uses the internet to allow people who are excited about a cause to get the vote out without having to spend money, without having to be beholden to corporate interests. And he ended it with, I've got to go and build this now. And, you know, it was really just perfect. And when I finished the book, I knew that I wanted to have a couple of afterwards. The little brother, the first book, also had two afterwards. And I wanted he and Jacob Applebaum from WikiLeaks to write me afterwards. And I wrote to him and I said, write me a letter to a kid like you, but who's like 14 today, and tell me what you would tell them. And Aaron wrote an amazing, you know, to the barricades kind of letter. And it was great. And so, you know, now I find myself touring with this book that he contributed to in pretty important ways. And, you know, there we can talk a lot about the causes and the things that Aaron believed in. I think that there's a mistaken belief that Aaron had some political philosophy that revolved around information wanting to be free. I've been on this side of the barricade for a long time. I've never met anyone who cared about what information wanted. I think Aaron wanted people to be free and believe that one of the ways that you make people free is with information. And so I talk about that a lot when I go out on tour and I talk to people about it. I've been talking about it for years. But one thing I've been talking about that's a little different, especially after talking with Aaron's family a bit, is I talk about suicide a little. Because, you know, whatever else was happening in Aaron's life, it didn't get better after he killed himself. You know, his problems are not solved through his death. And in technology, we are very conscious of what one another are doing, you know, especially in high-tech circles. I, you know, there are people who I haven't seen in years, but I know everywhere they go, I know what they've eaten, I know what they're doing, but I know very little about what they're feeling. And we need to attend to that because, of course, depression is a universal, and it seems to happen a lot in high-tech circles. There seems to be some nexus of finding grace in machines and sometimes feeling despair about humanity.
It can be very isolated. It can be isolating. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't make you, but it can.
Yeah, and we've lost a couple of people from our community to suicide in the last couple of years, and it's very sad. And so I've been going around and talking to people and saying, look, you know, we've all been depressed. Many of us, including myself, have felt suicidal ideation. But the one thing that you need to know is that you will never get out of that funk by dying. Dying doesn't solve that problem. It is the one thing you can be sure that will not solve the problem. It's because you can't iterate from dying. Right, you can't try dying, see if it fixes your problem, and if it doesn't, try something else.
Right,
and so you know, I've been talking about that with audiences for the last couple of days since I hit the road, and I will continue to talk about it all this month, and I think for a long time to come, and I hope that if there is one element of Aaron's legacy that we take on, it's that we start talking about our feelings and talking to one another about them and being more emotionally available to one another in high-tech circles especially and you know, being quiet and attentive when people want to talk about this stuff and even going to people proactively and saying, can we talk about this stuff?
I'm Rabia Yeaman with The Digital Divide. I'm talking today with Cory Doctorow. Cory's in Portland this week to promote his most recent science fiction novel, Homeland. Well, I wanted to talk about your fans. So would you say that, you know, your audience, I mean, is it like, is there a highly literate group of teenage computer hackers who might be your fan base, or do your stories appeal to kind of an ageless category of science fiction fans?
Well, there's lots of adults who read my work, and there's also lots of adolescents and even kids who read it. And I've heard now that I've been writing young adult fiction for 5 years, I have kids who started off reading it when they were kids and are now in law school or in engineering programs who say, you know, this made me want to be a lawyer, this made me want to be an engineer, this made me want to get involved in this stuff. Some of them are now career activists, and it's very, very, very rewarding to hear that. I think that young adult fiction is not fiction solely for young adults. It's fiction that can be enjoyed by young adults and by adults, and that can be shelved by a young adult librarian without getting fired. And I think that young adult fiction has a particular excitement because the lives of adolescents are very exciting, because adolescents do things for the first time that you and I have done a million times. And when we do them, they're banal. But when a young adult does them, they're incredibly exciting. You know, the first time you tell a lie of consequence, the first time you do something noble for a friend, you're doing something that will change you forever. You have no way to predict on the way in how it will change you. And when it's done, you're a different person for the rest of your life. And so that's an immensely brave and crazy thing to do. And kids do it all day long. And so it makes them very good characters to write. And it makes their stories really interesting.
Are you in there, the young you, the you that's still young on the inside? Are you in your books?
Well, in as much as, you know, there's exactly one person in the entire world whose internal thought process I'm an expert on, and that's me. So anytime I write any other person, it has to be me in a mask, right? I mean, you know, or me through some lens, because there's no one else whose internal processes I have firsthand knowledge of. That said, I was never as cool as Marcus. He may be aspirational, but he's certainly not inspired by my life. So
let's hear Corey read an excerpt from his book, Homeland.
The car came to a stop. We'd been driving for a few minutes or 100 years, take your pick. The divider between the front and the back of the car slid down with that kind of purring near silence of a really well-engineered mechanism. The guy in the front, whose ultra-short hair revealed a gnarly knob of scar tissue that ran from the crown of his head to the tendon standing out on the back of his neck, turned around to look at us. I looked past him, trying to figure out where we'd come. There was water, some dark shapes that might be boats, some industrial-looking buildings. I thought it must be China Basin, a landfill neighborhood that was a mix of abandoned warehouses and factories, and trendy condos and offices built into former abandoned warehouses and factories. Judging from the boarded-up windows and the plastic bags and other ancient trash caught in the trees, this was the actual abandoned part. "Well, here we are," Timmy said and rubbed his hands together. He and the other man exchanged a long look. "Marcus," Timmy said, turning back to me, "you know what the deal is now. We need what you've got back. We'll take whatever steps you make us take to convince you that that's the right thing to do. If you need us to take you where your little friend is so she can explain the facts of life to you, that's what we'll do. I don't think you want that, do you? I think you'd like to have this unpleasantness behind you quickly and with a minimum of mess." The other man twisted his face into an ugly smile. "You don't want a mess, buddy. You really don't want a mess." I knew he was saying it to intimidate me, but it worked. "On the other hand," Timmy said, accepting a little bottle of mineral water from his friend and sucking back half of it in one go, "you could just give us what we want, and we'll give you a ride to anywhere you'd like to go. You'd be out of this business, we'd get to knock off early and hit the strip bars, and you'd even get a free taxi ride out of it. It's up to you. Are you a smart guy, Marcus, or are you a stupid guy?" I tried to find peace and calm, but it wouldn't come. So I looked for anger, which is an easy place to get to from scared, and yeah, there it was. "You guys are so full of it," I said. "You must think I'm a complete tard. I open up my laptop and nuke the file, and then what? You believe that's my only copy and you let me go? Please, if that file is so important to you, you're never going to trust me." Timmy laughed and thumped the car door. "Oh, Marcus, come on. We're pros. We know how to do this kind of thing. We wouldn't take you along with us if we didn't have to. Where we're headed, it's a nice place. It's a reward and an honor to get assigned there. The people there, they're elite. You wouldn't fit in. If we have any choice in the matter, we'll leave you right where we found you." I tried again for a poker face. Yeah, sure they'd leave me. In a garbage bag at the bottom of San Francisco Bay. "Or maybe you think we want to off you? Now that wouldn't make any sense.
Smart guy like you, you'd have lots of copies where we couldn't find them, but where they'd be sure to come to light someday if you weren't around. We want your cooperation, and we can only get that for so long as you're alive.
And so long as you've got something to lose, the other guy said. Bad cop.
Show him, Timmy said. The guy in the front seat got out and walked around the car, closing the door behind him with another well-engineered thunk. The car rocked a little on its suspension as he opened it and got something out. His shoes crunched softly on the ground as he came around and opened the passenger side door and slid in. He was holding a heavy-duty ballistic plastic equipment case, another tactical black number, with big, chunky latches that had worn away to show little glints of silver metal beneath the matte black paint. He thumbed the latches and opened the case, which made a little gaskety, rubbery sound as it opened. It had been filled with foam rubber with precise cutouts to accommodate a little black box, some wires, and assorted discs of plastic and clips.
Polygraph, the man said.
It was such a pleasant surprise that I found myself on the verge of laughter. Polygraph is the fancy, semi-scientific name for a lie detector, a machine that's supposed to be able to tell whether you're fibbing by measuring things like galvanic skin response, another sciencey word meaning sweatiness, and your heart rate. They were invented in 1921, and like many sciencey things, people decided they were so complicated that they must work. This, of course, is an insane reason to believe something. Lie detectors are crap. What they tell you is whether the person that they've been hooked up to is sweaty or whether his pulse has gone up, but that doesn't mean he's lying. Courts don't admit lie detector evidence for a reason. But they're still made and they're still used, for much the same reason that people still wear crystals around their neck to cure their diseases or buy homeopathic remedies to get better. It's a combination of two distinct flavors of stupidity. I call the first one, it's better than nothing. I call the second one, it worked for me. These delusions are why many big corporations, the U.S. military and the FBI, subject their people to lie detectors. Imagine that you're some kind of millionaire big-shot company executive, the founder of a chain of successful convenience stores. You need to hire a regional manager, and if you hire the wrong person, he or she might rob you blind and ruin you. So you need to get this right. So you pay some expensive executive recruiting company to find the right person. They have a big sales pitch. We're smart, we've been doing this for years, and best of all, we're scientific. We have scientific personality tests we'll administer to make sure that you're getting the right person. And before you hire that person, we'll wire her up to our lie detector and ask her some important questions like, are you planning on robbing the company, and are you a secret drug user, and so on. Science is awesome, right? A scientific recruiting company is going to be totally badass at finding you the right person using the science of hiring-ology, and their science lab must have a bunch of PhD hireologists. But you've heard that the polygraph is, you know, kind of sketchy. Does it really work? Oh, sure, the consultants tell you. Not perfectly, of course, but nothing's perfect. Polygraphs, though, sometimes tell you when someone is lying. And isn't that better than nothing? The correct answer is probably not. Flipping a coin or sacrificing a goat would sometimes tell you if someone was lying, if you had enough lines, if you had enough lies and enough goats and you did it for long enough. Now, imagine that you're a section chief at the FBI. You got your job by passing a lie detector test. You'd been wired up, and you'd been asked if you were a secret communist, Islamo-fascist, terrorist, dope fiend. You'd said no, and the machine agreed. It works! Now, some people out there say the machine's a piece of crap, but what do they know? After all, it not only worked on you, it worked on everybody you work with. Of course, everyone it didn't work on wasn't hired, or was hired even though they're snorting lines of meth through rolled-up pages of the Communist Manifesto while they strap on their suicide bombs. The world is full of sciencey crap. You probably know someone who wears a copper bracelet to help with the arthritis. They might as well burn a witch or cover themselves in blue mud and dance widdershins under a full moon. There's a chance either those things will make them feel better because of the placebo effect, which is when your brain convinces itself to stop feeling bad. But there are an alarming number of people who insist that because something works, it must not be a placebo. It must be real. These guys wanted to wire me up to a lie detector and sacrifice a goat and figure out if I'd lied to them. They were big and tough and rich. They were faster than I was, and they were infinitely better armed, but they'd let a witch doctor sell them a magical lie-detecting talisman, and so I was going to absolutely pwn them.
They watched me enter my password on my computer, made a show of recording it with yet another black rubber tactical gizmo. It was like these guys had an infinite supply of grown-up Tonka toys. A webcam with a white LED that lit my fingers with harsh, uncompromising light as I entered it. They watched as I fired up TrueCrypt and brought up my hidden partition, watched as I did a directory listing and showed them the files, watched as I nuked them. Okay, that's fine, but what about your backups, Marcus? Maybe they weren't totally stupid. I've got a lot of backups, I admitted, but I think I can solve that problem for you. Yeah? Tell me. Timmy was smiling again, all his smile lines crinkling, making him look like he was enjoying himself, and he wanted me to enjoy myself too. I started to get the feeling that Timmy might wear exactly that same smile if he was cutting off my fingers or taping electrical wires to my testicles. Well, I encrypt all my backups, of course. Well, of course. And I need a key to get at the backups, right? Sure. So what if I delete the key? Haven't you backed up the key? Yeah, I said. I'll need to get online and erase it in a few places. But once it's gone, everything is gone. Might as well be random noise. The other guy, Knothead, was holding the webcam with its bright light shining at me, and I couldn't make out his face. But when Timmy shifted his attention to him, he lowered the light, and I saw that he was wearing a tactical earpiece. I wondered how many times these guys dropped something small and important on the floor and then lost it forever as its black paint job rendered it invisible. I wondered if any of them had been goths in an earlier life. Probably not. Knothead raised one thick finger. He was listening to someone on the earpiece. So the webcam must be streaming over the net to someone else, a technical expert who was watching everything I did, helping them figure out what to do. He nodded twice, said, "Check that," and turned to us. "Do it," he said. "We'll polygraph him later." Timmy said, "I'm about to give you a Wi-Fi password for the car. You're going to get a chance to do what you say you're doing. We're going to see what you do. We're going to verify what you do. If we can verify it, you get to go home. It's that simple. Do we have a deal?" Before, I'd been afraid. Now I was afraid they'd see how happy I was. That was important, because what I was about to do depended on them believing that I was very, very nervous. I keyed in the Wi-Fi password and waited while I connected. I wondered what sort of link I was on. I figured if I were them, I'd be running everything through an SSL tunnel to a Tor router somewhere on the net, so that everything came through nicely anonymized. Why not? If it was good enough for paranoid freaks like me, it'd suit them just fine. That was the thing about this stuff. It worked equally well for everyone. People who had leaks, people who worried about leaks, people who leaked leaks. We were all smart enough to keep our paranoid packets bouncing around the net like hyperactive super balls. Certainly the connection was slow enough.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Oh, now, thank you.
Your book is available at Powell's?
Yeah, Powell's and at stores across the city and across the country. Depending on what time we get out of here, I think I'm going to go sign even more stores. I signed at the Children's Place this morning, and I'm signing stock at stores all around town.
Well, that's very exciting. And people can find you online where?
Well, I'm the first Corey in Google. Just put C-O-R-Y into Google. Or you could go to boingboing.net or craphound.com or whatever. But I'm the first Corey in Google. It's the easiest way to find me.
I want to be the first Corey in Google.
You could be if your name was Corey, maybe.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Rabia Yeaman for The Digital Divide. I'm here with Cory Doctorow, and have a great rest of your tour.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers.
on a certain square, down the dirty stairs, to see the table set with golden chairs. Hard to follow.